WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm David Biancooley, TV critic for the New York Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. Our guest today is the author of many best-selling mock Victorian novels for children. They tell the tales of three unlucky orphans who lead lives filled with misery and woe, as they are constantly on the run from a repulsive and treacherous villain and endure terrible accidents, itchy clothing, and bad singing. These novels are collectively known as A Series of Unfortunate Events. They're written by Lemony Snicket, the pen name of Daniel Handler. Handler's eerie characters are about to hit the big screen, starring Jim Carrey, the same rubbery actor who brought the Grinch to three-dimensional life. In the film being released next week, called Lemony Snicket's A Series of Unfortunate Events, Carrey stars as the evil Count Olaf and also plays many other roles. In this scene, he's accepting delivery of his distant relatives, the three Baudelaire children, orphaned after their wealthy parents have perished in a fire.
I will raise these orphans as if they were actually wanted. And though you would call it a burden, a sacrifice, you are mistaken, sir, and should be ashamed of yourself. The idea! Anyway, where do I sign for the fortune? I mean, children.
Oh, you won't officially have guardianship until the hearing on Thursday morning.
And what am I to do with them until then?
Excuse me?
What I mean is, do you work out? You look good, healthy, I mean.
When Terry spoke with Daniel Handler in 2001, they started with a reading from the first Lemony Snicket book, The Bad Beginning, which begins, as Snicket often does, with a warning to his readers.
If you are interested in stories with happy endings, you would be better off reading some other book. In this book, not only is there no happy ending, there is no happy beginning and very few happy things in the middle. This is because not very many happy things happened in the lives of the three Baudelaire youngsters. Violet, Klaus, and Sonny Baudelaire were intelligent children, and they were charming and resourceful and had pleasant facial features, but they were extremely unlucky, and most everything that happened to them was rife with misfortune, misery, and despair. I am sorry to tell you this, but that is how the story goes.
A little further into the story, we find out that the Baudelaire's parents just perished in a fire that also destroyed their home. And so their endless misfortunes begin. Now, your book, as we heard, starts with a warning that readers might be better off with a more cheerful book. Why did you decide to start your book that way?
Well, it seemed only fair to warn anyone who was seeking cheerfulness. And also, when I sat down to start writing for children, I really had no bearing in children's literature. I hadn't read a book for children since I was a youngster. And but I remembered this overwhelmingly moralistic tone in all of my least favorite books. So I thought it might be good to sort of mock that from the outset and warn children away from the story instead of the sort of typical treacly beginning, which is, you know, this is a very charming story and you're just going to love the adorable hero.
What are some of the terrible things that have happened to these orphans?
Oh, well, I mean, it's such a depressing list. I hate to think of drivers listening to NPR driving off the road as I list them off. I mean, they meet Count Olaf, who is a distant relative who is only after the fortune that their parents have left behind. He's a terrible person who tries to marry the eldest Baudelaire, Violet, and locks up the baby in a birdcage and dangles it outside of his tower window. They go to stay with their kindly Uncle Monty, who's murdered. They go to stay with their Aunt Josephine, who throws herself out of a window, or at least so it appears. They're forced to work in a lumber mill. They go to school. That's always a terrible thing. They stay with rich people and find themselves falling down an elevator shaft. They're driven out of town by an angry mob with torches and barking dogs. And then in the most recent volume, they find themselves prepared for unnecessary surgery in the hospital. So it's really quite a cornucopia of terrible things.
It was a lot of literary jokes, like little in references that only adult readers would get, or at least teenage readers. You know, like the orphans are named the Baudelaire children. Their first names are Klaus and Sonny, two of them. You want to name some of the other little references?
Well, they're cared for by Mr. Poe. They're at one point they fall into the household of Jerome and Esme Squalor, who are named after J.D. Salinger's story for Esme with Love and Squalor. They attend Prufrock Preparatory School after the poem by T.S. Eliot. Yeah, they're pretty much surrounded by the world of books. I liked the idea of a universe that was governed entirely by books. The Baudelaires find the solutions, or what appear to be the solutions to their problems, in libraries in each volume. And so there's sort of some heavy-handed, or I hope mock heavy-handed, propaganda saying that all of life's difficulties can be solved within the pages of the right book.
Well, another thing you do in your books is you use kind of big words, and then you define them for your readers. Let me read an example. This comes from the last page of your first Lemony Snicket book. And the sentence is, "The car drove farther and farther away until Justice Strauss was merely a speck in the darkness. And it seemed to the children that they were moving in an aberrant," the word aberrant here means very, very wrong and causing much grief, "into an aberrant direction." Tell me how you developed that approach to taking a big word that may be above the reading level of your readers, and then managing to humorously define it within the sentence.
Well, it wasn't really as artificial as that. I mean, I just like a lot of words, and I wanted to put them in these books. And as I was writing them when I was writing the first book, it would occur to me that maybe aberrant was a word that wasn't known to many third graders. And so then it seemed to fit right into this mock moralizing tone that the narrator would stop often at very, very suspenseful moments and define the word in a way that was hopelessly bound to that individual context. And so it makes me very happy to know that that now, I mean, there's sort of millions of fourth graders who know what the word ersatz means, and that's or know what the expression casing the joint or understand dramatic irony. That really excites me. So I don't sit around pedagogically and think, well, what can I teach the little nippers? But I just love these words, and I just wanted to put them in my books. There are not enough books that have the word corpulent, in my opinion.
Your new novel is set in Heimlich Hospital. Little Heimlich maneuver joke in there.
Well, I think he's such an unheralded medical phenomenon. It would only seem fair to put him in at least one book.
Why a hospital?
Well, hospitals are really terrifying places, I think, for children and for adults. And they're also places that are so often sanitized in children's literature. There's this sense that children ought not to worry when they go into the hospital. And so there are all these books that say, oh, the hospital's really a fun place and everyone there just wants to make you better and you get to watch TV and eat ice cream all day long and it's really quite a pleasure. And that just seems terrible to me to tell a child that they're not going to have a scary time in the hospital. Of course they're going to have a scary time in the hospital.
Now, there's a group of professionals in your novel whose job it is to cheer up the people in the hospital. And initially, the Baudelaire children hide out in their van. And this is how they end up in the hospital. They're hiding out in this van carrying a group called Volunteers Fighting Disease. And this is a van of people who go to the hospitals to cheer up the sick. And they sing this weird, seemingly cheerful song. Would you recite the song that you wrote for them to sing?
Yes, of course. "We are volunteers fighting disease, and we're cheerful all day long. If someone said that we were sad, that person would be wrong. We visit people who are sick and try to make them smile, even if their noses bleed or if they cough up bile." And the chorus is, "Tra-la-la, fiddle-dee-dee, hope you get well soon. Ho-ho-ho, he-he-he, have a heart-shaped balloon." We visit people who are ill and try to make them laugh, even when the doctor says he must saw them in half. We sing and sing all night and day, and then we sing some more. We sing to boys with broken bones and girls whose throats are sore. tra-la-la, fiddle-dee-dee, hope you get well soon. Ho-ho-ho, he-he-he, have a heart-shaped balloon. We sing to men with measles and to women with the flu, and if you breathe in deadly germs, we'll probably sing to you. Tra-la-la, fiddle-dee-dee, hope you get well soon. Ho-ho-ho, he-he-he, have a heart-shaped balloon.
What do you think of the song? How would you feel if this song were sung to you?
Well, I think I would have that that same annoyed feeling that I always feel if I'm surrounded by people who are singing to me in order to cheer me up. I mean, I think every child and adult knows the horror of it, of going to a restaurant and having it turn out to be the sort of restaurant where everybody stands around and sings happy birthday. And it's that same dread that I tried to capture in those lyrics.
I'd like to hear an example of a song that you do like, so I thought I'd ask you to do this. Stephen Merritt, who is with the group Magnetic Fields and is probably best known for his CDs, 69 Love Songs, which is 69 songs in every imaginable genre of love songs, and some of them are straight songs and some of them are parodies of love songs. Anyways, he...
And some of them are decorated with accordion played by myself.
Uh-huh. And you and he are old friends. You wrote the liner notes for his CD, and he's writing a series of songs to accompany the audio versions of your books.
Mm-hmm.
So perhaps you can sing unaccompanied one of those songs?
Certainly. This is the song that he composed that I perform when I'm usually in front of an audience of children. And usually I'm accompanying myself on the accordion, but today will be a cappella due to some accordion-related trouble. The Count has an eye on his ankle and lives in a horrible place. He wants all your money. He's never at all funny. He wants to remove your face. And you might be thinking what a romp this is, but wait till you meet his accomplices. When you see Count Olaf, you're suddenly full of disgust and despair and dismay. In the whole of the soul of Count Olaf, there's no love. When you see Count Olaf, count to zero. Then scream and run away. Scream, scream, scream and run away. Run, 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 or die. Die, 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 die.
Very good. I like that. Did you write the lyric?
Thank you. No, that's Mr. Merritt's invention thoroughly.
But based on your character?
Yes.
So I'm glad you get to sing that at your readings. It goes over well, I assume.
Well, yes, we usually encourage everyone's least favorite thing, audience participation. So during the part where I sing run, everyone runs. And then the part where I sing die, everybody slumps over on the floor. And really, you haven't lived until you're standing in an independent bookstore watching a lot of 8 and 9-year-olds slump over as if dead.
Daniel Handler speaking to Terry Gross in 2001. Under the pen name Lemony Snicket, he writes the best-selling children's series, A Series of Unfortunate Events. Jim Carrey stars in the film based on the series, which will open next week. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's interview with Daniel Handler, who writes the mock Victorian children's novels, A Series of Unfortunate Events. He uses the pen name Lemony Snicket.
Now, you write your Series of Unfortunate Events novels under the pseudonym of Lemony Snicket. How did you come up with that name?
Well, first off, I should say that I'm not sure pseudonym is exactly right, because the character of Lemony Snicket, this man who speaks directly to the reader and also who is tangentially involved in the stories that he's telling, is really more of a character. We just thought it would be fun to publish the books under the name of this character. But the name Lemony Snicket I actually had lying around before I had any desire to write for children. I was researching the first of two novels that I've published under my own name, the first novel, The Basic Eight, and I needed to contact, for research purposes, some right-wing political organizations and religious groups, and I wanted material mailed to me, but I didn't want to be on their mailing list for obvious reasons. And so someone asked me, so what is your name? And I opened my mouth, and out popped the words Lemony Snicket. And it became, among all of my friends then, a joke, we would write letters to the paper and sign them Lemony Snicket, hoping they would be published and reserve tables in restaurants under the name Lemony Snicket and all sorts of things like that. And so for a small select group of the population, the idea that the name Lemony Snicket has risen to such notoriety is particularly shocking.
Do you have much merchandising involved with your books?
No, really none as yet. We gave away some Band-Aids for the Hostile Hospital that said unfortunate event on them. I'm pretty proud of those. And we just had some terrible greeting cards just in time for the holidays, which are available at one of the chain bookstores. Greeting cards that say things like, why haven't you called? And it's all downhill from here.
If people start asking you more about merchandising, is there a place where you would insist on drawing the line, something that you, some kind of typically commercial way of merchandising children's literature that you wouldn't want to be part of?
Well, gosh, it's such a slippery slope. I mean, I always think, well, it would really be horrible to be associated with fast food, but then not too long ago I had a fantasy that, there would be unhappy meals that would come out of a series of unfortunate events. Maybe a little mad cow disease in the burger or just whatever we could do to really make them unsavory. No, I don't know. It's very difficult to say. More and more children write to me or come up to me in bookstores and say, in effect, what else is there that I can buy? And it's sort of it's both a frightening question and an understandable one. And I hope that if there is any merchandise, that it will be the sort of merchandise that that encourages people who buy it to really have fun in their imaginations. I mean, on one hand, a movie like Star Wars seems over-merchandised, but it would really be impossible to overemphasize how much fun I had when I was a kid playing with all the Star Wars characters and making up my own stories, and I think becoming a storyteller rose out of that kind of play. So it's very hard to tell. It's so easy to say, oh, well, I shouldn't have any of my literature sullied by commercial attention. But once you begin to actually think of how people would use what other people want to make, it's also hard to say no.
Have you run into any parents, teachers, or librarians who object to either the tone or the content of your books?
Not nearly as many as I thought I would. I really thought that there would just be an overwhelming wave of outrage, and instead there have just been a few isolated complaints that I've heard. We were banned in one school district in Decatur, Georgia. I'll always have that. They can't take that away from me.
What grounds were you banned?
Well, I hate to get too catty about Decatur, Georgia, but they were very concerned in the bad beginning that Count Olaf wants to marry Violet, who is a distant relative. And this strikes me as something that, without being too stereotypical about the South, that perhaps Decatur, Georgia has heard of before, let's just say. And also, I'm at a loss for how to construct a villain who isn't doing villainous things. If Count Olaf were only doing things that no one would object to, then he really wouldn't be much of a villain. So I'm somewhat nonplussed by that kind of criticism that, boy, Count Olaf is sure a terrible person. And so I always have to write back and say, well, yes, I'm... Yes, he is. He sure is. Let's catch him. And a woman once in Oregon came up to me at a bookstore and said, you know, in one of your books you teach that it is sometimes necessary to lie. And that seems like a very disturbing lesson to me. Can you name one time when it would be absolutely necessary to lie? And I was so happy that the answer came to me right away instead of, you know, as it usually does when people say something to you and then you think 3 days later, oh, that's what I should have said. Instead, it came right away and I was able just to turn to her and say, nice sweater. I'm just really proud of that.
What was her reaction?
I think she said thank you. I'm not sure that the lesson was taught, but at least I was able to sleep at night knowing that I'd been able to say something in response. I mean, of course you have to lie. I can't imagine that you would want to teach your child never to lie under any circumstances. That's not going to serve the child well when the child goes to a birthday party and is forced to say whether or not he or she had a nice time.
Well, Daniel Handler, thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Daniel Handler, speaking to Terry Gross in 2001.